on more complicated stuff. No, nothing. Everything was crystal clear last week. You completely understand the Torah code. Okay. Good. Then you're well suited to be able to understand this week's. I hope. Remember, it's at the end of last time we started discussing. Well, the Torah code, remember, had these excitations, which were identified as anions, because when you moved, so the excitations being, remember, defects where the stabilizer generators were not satisfied. And when you moved one of these defects around another defect of the other kind, it got this weird phase, right? A factor of minus one for the qubit Torah code, but a factor of omega, d root of unity, for the d-dimensional qubit Torah code. Right? Does that sound familiar? We discussed that you can have more exotic types of anions that get weirder things that happen when you move them around each other. And you can even have non-abelian anions, where it matters what order you do them in, right? And so then to describe the whole process, remember this is in two dimensions, to describe the whole process of moving one anion around another, you do some braid. Right, which we could draw, you know, pictures like. Like this to describe what happened. Right, and then the computation was going to correspond to some braid. And in fact, we discussed that by having sufficiently complicated non-abelian anions, which turns out in some ways they're very complicated, in some ways they're not all that complicated. You can actually have universal computation just by doing braids like this. And so what we're going to discuss today is a specific model that has that property of non-abelian anions, and kind of a general framework for talking about properties that an anion model should have. So I don't know too much about physical realizations of this model, and there's a bunch of people working on that now. One I mentioned last week was the quantum Hall effect. Other people have discussed trying to simulate these kinds of anionic models using some other kind of quantum computer, using superconductors or optical lattices or something like that, where you put on some interactions that give it a Hamiltonian that's supposed to make it display these anions. And then there's always the possibility of somebody finding some other physical system that happens to behave in the right way and have these anionic properties. But we'll just talk about the theoretical side, I mean the abstract theoretical side of what the model is today. Okay, so remember, one of the peculiar things I think I mentioned about these anions last time is that their Hilbert space is not going to be a tensor product of Hilbert spaces of the individual particles. Right? And the reason for that, at least at some level of motivation, is that we want this to be fault tolerant. Right? So if we attach information to each individual particle, well, the particles themselves are localized. And so something then local that happens would be able to mess up that particle. But the fault tolerance in the case of these anions is going to take place because we're keeping them far apart. So we're only really allowed for this fault tolerant thing to use degrees of freedom that are not localized to particles, but are somehow collective of the particles taken together. Okay, and so in order to get a good grasp of that, we're going to have to see what happens when we take two particles and combine them to look at a bigger Hilbert space of the particles collectively. Okay, so that's going to be a phenomenon called this fusion. So the idea is we're going to have two anions, and well, we could think of them separately, But we could also think of them together. So fusion can either be physical fusion, where we take these two things and try to force them together and get one merged particle that might have different properties. Or we can just think of it as a conceptual thing, where we draw a circle around these particles and squint our eyes and just think of them as acting together. So if we wanted to braid these particles around some other particle, we do it together, we move them both. Yes, right, that's right. So as it happens, we won't actually, we'll be moving them one by one, but still looking at the fusion is important in order to understand the Hilbert space of the collective system. And so mostly we'll just be thinking of this conceptual version, where we treat the particles as a unit in order to figure out what the Hilbert space of the whole thing is. And then we're going to have a way of going between different ways of doing this by moving the particles around. And then we'll get to that in a minute. Okay? So this is a little like in the qubit toric code. Remember, we could measure the charge of a single anion, right? So there were these like two types of charges, right? The X types and the Z types. But they also had a value, right, which told us what root of unity we were using. And you could measure that by measuring the stabilizer generator that was supposed to be satisfied by the things, right? But it didn't have to be that specific stabilizer generator. It could be anything in a loop around this particle. Because the other stabilizer generators were satisfied, which lets you deform loops, right? And so in this case, if you were to look at the qubit toric code, you could measure the charge. These were two different anions. You could measure the total charge by measuring the appropriate stabilizer element that goes in a loop around both particles at once. Okay, and the eigenvalue of that will tell you the total charge of the two particles. Okay, so similarly, in this case, we're going to combine them and have some idea of the charge of the combined particles. But there'll be multiple ways to do that. And that would be the Hilbert space of these combined pair of particles. At least in general, there could be multiple ways. OK, so that's all very vague, I know. But let's be a little more concrete. So in particular, an anion model has a set of charges. And one of those charges is going to be a trivial charge, no charge. So that trivial charge kind of corresponds to having no particle there at all, right? So in the case of the qubit toric code, that was the case where the stabilizer, the appropriate local stabilizer generator actually was satisfied, had eigenvalue plus one. Okay? And the other thing is that these charges are going to be paired. For every charge, there's going to be an anti-charge. If we have a charge Q, there is an anti-charge. Q bar. And The anti-charge is Q again. Okay? So to be very specific, let's think of one particular model that has just two charges, 0 and 1. So 0 is the trivial charge. Oh, yeah, and in general, the trivial charge is its own anti-charge. So in this case, 0 bar is also equal to 0. And that means that 1 bar has to equal 1, because it's the only thing left. So this model is called, well, in the quantum computing community, it seems to be called Fibonacci anions for reason, sorry, one N, two C's, for reason I'll get to in a little bit. But it also, I guess, has another name in the appropriate field theory community, the Yang-Li model. Okay. So this part is, I hope, simple enough that there's no questions. But I won't be offended if there are questions. Okay. And for simplicity, let's imagine that these particles are arranged on a line, left to right. Remember, we're working in two dimensions, so they could really be anywhere in the plane. But we'd like to be able to say, well, this is the first particle, this is the second particle, this is the third particle. We just want an ordering of them. So we might as well say they're on a line. Okay? And that's going to be true in the general case as well as the specific case. And if you imagine, I mean, if you think back to this grade picture, that's kind of compatible with that, right? And we're imagining we've taken this three-dimensional picture of the grading and pressed it down into a plane, which in turn presses them down into a line, right? The individual particles. Now there's some ambiguity at the point where they're passing each other. In that case, they're not really on a line anymore. But we just want to look at the intermediate times between the process, between the times when we swap. Okay. Okay. So no questions on that. Okay. So now let's talk about fusion. So in general, there's another part of the anion model is going to be fusion rules. The rules that tell us, well, when you take two of these particles and combine them, what do you get? So in general, if you take two charges, A and B, you might be able to fuse them into lots of different values of the fused charge. Fused charge has to be drawn from the same spectrum of possibilities. But, well, until you specify the model, you don't know which ones are possible. Okay. So how is it possible that you could have multiple different charges? Well, that's kind of the non-abelian part of this. That's where the non-abelian stuff can come in, because you're going to have a Hilbert space that's larger than a single thing. So you can't think of the toric code, even the Q-dip toric code, to tell you how this is going to happen. That's an abelian model. But maybe you can think a little bit about combining spins. It's not exactly the same, but it's kind of the same, right? So if you take two spin 1/2 particles, you can combine them together and get a spin 1 particle, or you can combine them in a singlet and get a spin 0 particle. Right? So it's kind of the same thing, as though you had a spin that you could two spins that you can combine two different ways to get a different total spin. In the same way, here we have two charges that we can combine in two different ways or more to get a different total charge. So in general, we're going to write an equation like this, A cross B equals sum over C, NABC, C, to represent these possibilities. Okay? So this is the number of ways that you can combine A and B to get charge C. Okay? So this might just be 1 or 0. And in Fibonacci model, that will be the case. But it could be something else. So in principle, you can have anion models where that n could be much larger. So let's see. So what properties do we have to satisfy with this N? Well, we know that the trivial charge, I mean, it's trivial, right? So we're thinking of it as not having any particles. So clearly, if we think of the picture up there where we draw a circle around a particle and nothing else, well, we should get the original charge always. Okay? So trivial. Fused with anything, with any particle A, always gets A. Okay, so for the Fibonacci model, Fibonacci model, N, 0, 0. Obviously, you can only get 0 out. So 0, 0, 0 is equal to 1, and 0, 0, 1 is equal to 0. And 1, 0, well, again, you can only get 1 out, right, if you fuse a 1 with a 0. That's what it means. So this is equal to 1, and this, N, 1, 0, 0, is equal to 0. Okay?
And all of that is symmetric, right?
Yes. And so, in fact, that's generally true. Not just for the trivial case, but N ABC is always going to equal to N BAC.
So, I might have missed something at some point, but when you talk about non-abelian, where's the non-abelianicity come from?
Well, we haven't quite gotten to that yet. So what's going to happen? But we've kind of almost stated it, and it's going to be involved here. So while these numbers of the number of this, I guess I didn't say that. NABC is a non-negative integer. Okay, so while the numbers here are the same, when we take AB or BA, the Hilbert spaces that we involve, well, they'll be isomorphic, but going from one to the other will change things. And so that's a unitary operation. And those unitary operations will not commute with each other. We'll explain this in more detail in a minute.
All right.
And that's important, right? Because NAB is when particle A is on the left and B is on the right, and BA is when we switch those, right? And so we want that to be different, right? Because we want there to be a braiding that goes along when we do that. But what this is just going to tell us is that the Hilbert space of particle A and then B is the same size as the Hilbert space of B and A. Okay? And maybe it's worth saying that now. So in fact, if we take two particles A and B and fuse them into C, we have a Hilbert space VABC, which has dimension NABC. Okay? So in other words, the overall Hilbert space of fused A and B is going to be a direct sum over different possible values of the total charge. Of these Hilbert spaces B, A, B, C. Okay? Okay? Everyone kind of see the idea here. And so we start to get something interesting in the Fibonacci model. Well, there's one important combination that we haven't considered here, right? Which is what happens when we fuse a 1 and a 1. And so it turns out that, well, in order to get something interesting, we need to have these not just be 1 and 0, they need to be 1 and 1. Right? So we're going to have n 1 1 is equal to 1, and n 1 1 0 is equal to 1 as well. So in other words, we would write 1 times 1 is equal to 1 plus 0, which is not nearly as trivial as it looks. Well, that's right. It does look trivial. But remember, these are not numbers. These are charges. And we're just using numbers to label the charges. So the connection with the usual arithmetic is a little ambiguous there. OK? So what this means in the case of if you look at the Hilbert space, so the Hilbert space of a single particle, so the Fibonacci model, is trivial. I mean, it's one-dimensional space. Okay, but now if you look at two 1 charges, and you look at the fusion space, now you have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, right? You have the Hilbert space that corresponds to the overall 0 charge, and the Hilbert space that corresponds to the overall 1 charge. Each of those is one-dimensional, but together you have a two-dimensional space. Okay.
Kind of based on the assumption that you'll be able to talk in between those spaces, right? Direct sum of all of those?
Yeah, okay. So that's an excellent point. And in fact, you may recall last time that I said that when we move things around, we would assume that charge was conserved. Okay? So that's true of the charges in the Torah code. And it's also true of the charges in these anion models. So in fact, you're right, that when we take these two particles and do whatever to them, this total charge is not going to change. So in that case, if we just have these two particles, there is no way we can get the 0 Hilbert space talk to the 1 Hilbert space. So it seems like it's not going to be very interesting. But it turns out that when we start adding more particles, more interesting things will happen.
Any intuition on why 2 1s would give another 1?
2 1s.
1 is 1.
So that's the way the model is defined. You have to be careful not to think of this in terms of an abelian anion model where the charge is like an electric charge, you know, that's coupling to some external field. It's just some local thing. You can tell it by going around the particle.
It looks like when we go around two of these.
So let's first of all think about how 1 and 1 could get a 0. Right? So think of 1 as something non-trivial is happening when you look at a path around one of these particles. But maybe there's something that kind of forces it to only be one possibility of just an isomorphism. So the idea is, so it might be that these two particles are entangled in some way so that these paths cancel out if you look at a path around both of them. And so that's the way they can combine to 0. But it might be that they don't cancel out and something still happens. I know that's not very good intuition. These models are hard to really understand intuitively, which is maybe why I'm treating them at this level. Abstraction. Sorry, I'm afraid I don't have too much help to offer there. But you're welcome to ask other questions to help pin it down in other ways.
Well, it's just a thought like that. I'm completely out of nowhere. So you have sort of one fuse with itself, kid itself, basically.
That's right. Well, it's one of the possibilities, yeah.
Yeah, could you sort of think about it as sort of a projector or something?
Well,
or like any identical.
Yes, in some sense. I mean, in that, so since the combined Hilbert space is a direct sum, you can look at the projector on subspaces that have different charges. So in that sense, well, except that the space of possibilities for one charge and the space of possibilities for two particles are kind of not really very comparable. So I'd be a little hesitant to do that. So anyway, in general, in this particular case, of the Fibonacci model, these Hilbert spaces are just two one-dimensional Hilbert spaces. So in that sense, there's not very much you can do. But you can imagine a more complicated Anion model. These numbers n could be larger than 1. They could be 2, 10, 17, whatever. And in fact, we're going to start to get larger numbers when we combine more particles, even in the Fibonacci model. Otherwise, it would be hard to really do anything. So it's useful to be able to talk about basis for these Hilbert spaces. And so the basis, we're going to draw the little pictures like this. So I guess here I switch from left to right to top to bottom. But the idea here is you can see that an A particle and B particle combining get a C particle. Right? So this is kind of the basis, one-dimensional basis of the one-dimensional Hilbert space VABC. And in the case where you have a bigger Anion model with more possibilities, you have to put some extra label on these pictures. Okay? So for instance, if this were a two-dimensional Hilbert space VABC, there would be another label that could be 0, 1, right, associated with this junction. I mean, if it'll help, you can put a cat around this. Okay, so this is just the name. This picture is going to be the name of the basis state for this particle, for this Hilbert space.
Right, was your junction?
Like, oh, so the point is, this is a two-dimensional. If this is a two-dimensional Hilbert space, the ABC.
Okay.
Then we need two pictures like this, right? So we're going to have to distinguish them somehow.
Okay.
So we might as well just put an extra label on here, which is associated with this thing as a whole.
And what if it's a zero-dimensional?
Well, so if it's a zero-dimensional, then it doesn't ever rise. And, I mean, you shouldn't have a picture associated with that. I mean, we might be careless and draw it anyway, but that would be, it doesn't represent anything physical. So the case of a zero-dimensional is like here, right, where you have two zero charges combining to form a one. Can't happen. Okay. 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 So. So in the case of the Fibonacci model, it was the charges were their own anti-charges, so there was kind of not very much interesting going on there. But in the general case, we have to worry, well, why did we say that a charge and anti-charge are paired, right? What is special about an anti-charge compared to the charge? And the answer is that the charge and the anti-charge, they can fuse into a trivial charge. And in fact, those are the only ones that can fuse into a trivial charge. You can't have a charge and a different charge, so unrelated charge, fuse into the trivial charge, right? And that is kind of understandable from the terminology. Right, that to get the charge is supposed to be conserved in some way. So anything that fuses with one charge to get zero should be its anti-charge in some sense. I guess it's not clear from what I've written before that that's unique, but that is the case for these NR models. So only Q bar. And furthermore, these anti-charges, yeah?
Can you more explicitly write out the basis for the two Fibonacci NEOM keys?
Sorry, for
the... Can you write out explicitly the basis?
So for the two-dimensional.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we might... we might have a basis something like, we might draw it like this. Okay, just put an extra label out of the set on the junction 0, 1. Okay? Oh, for the Fibonacci. Well, for the Fibonacci, oh, I see, yeah, okay. Sorry, so for the 1 cross 1 case, is the only one that's interesting. We have these two possibilities, right? We have 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1, 1. Okay, and because they have different total charges here, they're kind of not going to interact directly. But once we add more particles again, it will be interesting. Okay. So the other thing we can do with these anti-charges is we can get additional relations between these NABs. So if we switch a charge and anti-charge, then that raises or lowers one of these indices. So for instance, that tells us that NABC is equal to NAC bar B bar. Okay. Again, in the case of Fibonacci model, it's not very interesting because we only have charge is equal to their own anti-charge is. And there weren't very many of them in the first place. But obviously, for a more complicated anion model, this sets a lot of constraints on what we can have. Everyone at least understand the rule. Okay. Are there other questions?
Basic. Does it mean that you're rotating that diagram for the basis, and then you just add the?
Well, I mean, yeah. So we okay. So. There's different Hilbert spaces associated with these cases, which I guess, since the dimensions are the same, are going to be isomorphic Hilbert spaces. I don't think we're going to need to explicitly understand what that isomorphism is. The thing is, it's not something you can physically do, change your charge to an anti-charge. Whereas switching the order particles, for instance, is.
Right, so they're only isomorphic.
They're isomorphic. Well, right. So all these things are isomorphic, but there's no. We won't really need with that isomorphism. So I don't think it's really going to rise. Okay, so it's really at this point just a constraint on the possible. But the kind of made the motivation here is a little bit like if you've studied Feynman diagrams, right? Where you have, you know, electron. You know, electron has an arrow on it, right? And a positron is this. It's just the arrow going the other way. So it's kind of the same thing here, is that you can imagine these pictures as having arrows, right? And then and then by reversing the arrows, you'd be kind of reversing the directions. So this would be but in some sense, this is kind of the same picture, right? Because, sorry, this is B. Because B is pointing out of the vertex, and C is pointing out, just like here. OK, but they're pointing the opposite direction relative to the fusion rule. This is, again, just kind of at the level of the way you draw the diagram. So, but maybe it can help you understand the motivation here, in that it's a little bit like this the same thing is happening with particles and antiparticles in regular quantum field theory. Or maybe that's just confusing you more. Yeah?
I'm just requesting that. Can you sometimes make a little more explicit reference to a representation theory when you discuss some of these things? So that I think it helps me.
Well, so there's nothing to represent yet. Because we haven't done any operations, we don't have any proof yet. So right now, Hilbert space is, we've gotten as far as saying what the basis of the Hilbert space is. Okay. So we're going to get to a representation of the Bray group in a little bit. We haven't got it. Anything else? Okay. So the other thing we have. This is not, normally I've been doing left side for the general case and the right side for the Fibonacci ends. That's not going to be the case for this board. So we also have splitting rules. So if we have two particles like this, and we know that their total charge is C, what could the particles of the what could the charge of the individual particles be? Okay, and just logically, you can see that well. First of all, this has to be non-zero, only for cases where A and B can combine to C. So splitting rule, we write the same way. C is equal to sum over AB. And CAB of A cross B. Okay? And you can see that N CAB is going to be 0 only if the other way around is also true. And in fact, you can use this raising and lowering rule to actually get the relationship between these splitting rules and the fusion rules. So N CAB is in fact going to be equal to N A bar, B bar, C bar. Okay? And you can imagine that if you want in terms of these pictures by just flipping everything left to right.
So what's kind of the
has two subscripts? Sorry, so the two subscripts is what you get in the fusion rule, where you take two things and get one out. And the splitting rule has one subscript and two superscripts, where you take one thing and you break it up into two particles.
So
this is the fusion rule for particles A bar and B bar. And this is the splitting rule for particle C into A and B.
So you can only combine A bar, B bar, C bar if you can split C to A and B.
That's right. And the number of ways to do that is the same. OK. So maybe now let's look at something slightly more complicated. I hope that's OK. But it's inevitable, right? If you can combine two particles, you can combine three particles. OK, so when we choose three particles, the problem is that there's two possible ways we could do that. Right? We could either take, so we have three particles, A, B, and C. We could either combine A and B, and then combine that huge particle with C. Or we could do it the other way around. We could combine B and C, and then fuse together with A. I suppose we could also choose A and C and then combine with B. That's a little inconvenient because B is in the middle. But we could still do it. Okay, but let's just consider these two possibilities. OK, so what's going to happen is, well, let's draw the pictures associated with these two things. Well, so this one, we have A and B are going to fuse to give us a particle D. And then D chooses to give us, with C, to give us something else, E. OK? Whereas over here, we have the basis where, we have down here, we have B and C choose to give us D prime. And then A chooses with that to give us E. And we'd like to compare the case but have the same total charge in the end. Okay? And this D and the D prime, well, there's no reason to believe they're related, of course, because they have to be related somehow, but they could be different, right? I mean, we don't know anything about A, B, and C. This is for the arbitrary general case. But what we're going to say is that to go from this basis for the Hilbert, so that we have a Hilbert space associated with the three particles A, B, and C getting E. And since this fusion thing is just a conceptual thing of where we drew this dotted line around first, the Hilbert space of this could be the same as the Hilbert space of this. Right? So the number of basis states that we have here is the same as the number of basis states we have here. And how do we get from this basis to this basis? Well, there has to be some unitary transformation that does that. And that's going to be called the F matrix.
Any reason why we just don't define that it's a refusion rule?
What do you mean?
Well, like now you're sort of pairwise fusing.
Yes.
You fuse two and then fuse.
Oh, you mean why do you define it just by itself?
Yeah, you take three input, one output. Then.
So the point is that there'd be a lot of constraints on that because, you can define such numbers N, A, B, C, E, but you can figure out what they are just by looking at the two fusion rules. Okay, the number of ways to do this is just determined by what happens when you do it this way or this way. Those numbers have to be the same. Okay, and in particular, what I'd like to do, so you can certainly define that, but it's already given by the rules that we've determined. But I'd like to go further than that and say, well, how are the bases related, these pictures? OK, so the basis for the Hilbert space decomposed this way is going to be different from the basis of the Hilbert space decomposed this way. And there's going to be some matrix that maps between the two of them. And that's this F matrix. Or the fusion matrix. Okay? we say that if we look at kets that are written in this basis and apply the F matrix, we get kets written in this basis. So okay. This is this isomorphism that we're talking about. So in some literal sense, we have a different Hilbert space, V, A, B, C, E versus V, A, B, C, E. But they're isomorphic, and this F gives the isomorphism. OK? So now let's think about doing this for the Fibonacci analysis. So what can we do? Well, so if we have 0 and 0, that's not interesting. If we, in fact, choose 0 with anything, that's not interesting. So the interesting case is when we're choosing 1s together. So what can we do? Well, let's just think about choosing them in this order. Since the Hilbert space is going to be isomorphic, we don't have to really worry. We'll just do this one to count them. And we'll use this as our standard basis. So we're considering the case where these three are all ones. And what can happen? Well, these two confuse either 0 or 1. Right? So we have two possibilities here. We have this one and this one. Okay? And then this 0 and the 1 can only fuse in one way. So we get a 1 out here. So that's one state. And the 1 and the 1, well, they can fuse in two ways. So we have two possibilities. So this, they could fuse for 0. Or they could fuse for 1. Right? So if you look at this, you see what this means is that we have two ways of fusing three 1s into a 1. Right? But only one way of fusing three 1s into a 0. So saying that n 1, 1, 1, 0 is equal to 1, and n 1, 1, 1, 1 is equal to 2. OK? Everyone see that? OK. So now, in general, if we have N one particles, and we want to fuse them. Well, we'll have a tree that looks like this, right? And we can identify it by saying what's in here. So we have A, B, C, D, and E at the end here. Okay, so the bases are going to be associated with these sequences, A, B, C, D, E. But there's only certain sequences that can arrive, right? So if we have a 0 at any point here, the next one has to be a 1, because we're fusing a 0 with a 1. Whereas if we have a 1, then the next one can be either a 1 or a 0. So let's let this N So we'll define a simpler thing, so I don't have to keep on writing lots and lots of ones. So we're interested in these dimensions, N, N, A, that you get by fusing together N1s to get an A. And what do we know? Well, we know that to get, well, okay, so I guess in this case it's an E. But to get an E out, if E is a 0, we could have had either a 1 or a 0 here. Sorry, we could only have had a 1 here, right? Because only the 1 and the 1 can fuse to get a 0. Whereas the 0 and the 1 can fuse to get a 1. But the 1 and 1 can also fuse to get a 1. So we have N and 0 has to equal N minus 1, 1, right? So the number of ways we can get 0 out at the end is the number of ways we can get 1 here. Right? Whereas if we have, if we want to get 1 at the end, well, that we can either have a 0 here, and so we have a number of ways to get a 0 for D with N minus 1 particles. Or we could have a 1 here, and then the 1 and the 1 could also fuse to get a 1. So the number of ways to get a 1 is the sum of the number of ways with n minus 1 particles to get a 0 and the number of ways to get a 1 with n minus 1 particles. Okay? So in other words, plugging this into here, we get that n 1 is equal to n minus 1, 1 plus n minus 2, 1. Right? And this is the Fibonacci sequence. That's the name. And in fact, we know already what the first couple are. So we know that n, let's just start with 2, 1. Well, so how do we, when we fuse 2 ones together, how many ways are there to go to 1? There's just 1. And we know that n 3, 1 is equal to 2. Okay, so that sets up the initial conditions here that we can use. And let's see. So let's do a couple more, right? So what's so n 4-1 is some of these is 3, and 5-1 is 5. And 6-1 is 8, and 7-1 is 13. And then, of course, the zero charges are going to be the previous one. So it's 2, 3, 5, 6, 5, 8, and 8. So there's a reason I went to that. So what we're going to do, so the important thing is to notice that these numbers can be larger than 1. In fact, they get much larger than 1. So there's a couple of important things, actually. So one thing we want to notice is that because we have these numbers larger than 1, that means we have an Hilbert space that's larger than 1-dimensional, which means we can actually have an interesting quantum mechanics going on, even though we're fixing to look at a total charge of some specific value. So for reasons I don't really understand, people like to think of the total charge as 0. Maybe this is because one of the things I mentioned before, that we can think of pulling particles out of vacuum, right? Because of the splitting rules, the total charge, if you start with the vacuum, you have a charge 0. And the splitting rule says you can only get 2 ones out that way. Right? The total charge is still going to be 0. I mean, you could also get 2 zeros out, of course. But the point is the total charge stays the same in that case. So if you're pulling particles out of vacuum, the total charge is always going to be 0. That's the way to think about it. And I think that's why people are interested in this sector more than this sector. And in this sector, you can see that once you go up to 4 particles, you have a 2-dimensional Hilbert space. Right? A 2-dimensional Hilbert space, well, you think that's a qubit, right? So that's what we're going to do. We're going to take four 1 particles with a total charge of 0. And that's going to be our qubit. OK? But remember, these Hilbert spaces are not tensor product Hilbert spaces. And so what happens when you have what you'd like to be 2 qubits? You have 2 sets of 4 particles. Now you have 8 particles with a total charge of 0. And that's a 13-dimensional Hilbert space. OK? Which is both good and bad. So the bad news is, like I said, not a tensor product of those 2 2-dimensional Hilbert spaces. But the good news is that it's bigger. Right? If it was smaller, that would be a problem. Because that would mean that what we'd like to have, a qubit and a qubit, really they wouldn't separate it, and the global Hilbert space would be small. But since it's larger, that means that we can embed this tensor product Hilbert space of a qubit tensor a qubit inside this 13-dimensional Hilbert space. OK? And in general, it's true that the Fibonacci numbers grow exponentially. So I mean, there's, you know, it's kind of a standard arithmetic to calculate this. Okay, so the formula for n and 0 is, at least what I got, was 1 over square root of 5, phi of n. Minus 1 over phi, the end. Where phi here is 1 plus root 5 over 2. So this term has absolute value which is less than this term. So it's kind of negligible in the large n limit. And the point is that this Hilbert space is growing exponentially as you start to look at many, many particles. And if you chunk them up in sets of 4, well, I guess 5 over 4 is greater than 2. So that means the Hilbert space is growing faster than the Hilbert space of n qubits. So you can always embed the space of n qubits into this big Hilbert space, non-tensor product Hilbert space, of 4n anions in the Fibonacci model. OK? Questions? Yeah?
Why not just work in 13-dimensional space?
Well, so that's great if you're only interested in a 13-dimensional system. But then you have the same problem when you go to 2 sets of 8, right? In that the Hilbert space, well, you have to calculate what it is. But n16-0 is not 13 times 13.
No.
It's bigger than that.
But assuming you could do more with a smaller computer, if you just use the native dimension.
Yes and no, but it would be hard to represent in terms of our usual way of thinking about quantum gates. And this is maybe something important to say. What I'm thinking of today is using these topological models, these anions, to implement fault-tolerant quantum computation. So we're thinking of taking a regular quantum algorithm and implementing it on one of these anionic computers. And so to do that, we have to have some way of embedding a regular Hilbert space that can implement regular 2-qubit gates inside this bigger thing. But what you're asking is also very reasonable. Say, well, forget about that. Let's just think of this in its own time and see what kinds of interesting algorithms we can do with that. So it turns out that we can also, I mean, if you then go the other way and use extra qubits, you can embed these Hilbert spaces because they're growing. Well, so if you have, so since phi is I think it's less than 2. So in principle, you could embed these Hilbert spaces inside the same number of qubits, right? So n8 could be inside 8 qubits. So that actually, I mean, you need a little more work, but that actually lets you go the other way. So to show that these things are not actually even more powerful than regular quantum computers. So yes, you could maybe get some advantage, but it's only a constant number of qubits speed up or overhead reduction.
It's the first one you think it looks like these are particles that has 1.7, 1.6 dimensions or something. That's symbolically.
That's absolutely right. And I think actually this is called, this number 5 is called the quantum dimension of these anion systems. For exactly that reason. Okay? Other questions? Okay. Okay. Actually, now that I think about this, maybe somewhere accessible board. Okay, so the next thing we want to consider is this gradient. So in particular, what happens if we have two particles and we move them past each other? So what would that look like in terms of our pictures? Well, it would look something like, so we have a basis state that looks like this. And we'd like to map it to a basis state, well, where one of them has crossed over to the other one. So let's draw it this way. And A is now on top, and B is at the bottom. Okay. So in terms of the diagrams as I've drawn so far, the fact that this is crossing over doesn't really matter. It'd be the same. You just write A, B, C in a regular little wedge here. But remember, braiding is going to depend on whether we're doing it clockwise or counterclockwise. So this is going to kind of represent that. So there's basically going to be two. What's going to happen? So the Hilbert spaces with A, B here, and the Hilbert space with B, A here, those are isomorphic Hilbert spaces, right? They have the same dimension. And there's going to be two isomorphisms between them. So one of them is going to be the counterclockwise braiding, one of them is going to be the clockwise braiding. Okay? And so in particular, we're going to go between this one and this one using the R matrix. Let's call it the R matrix.
Those things actually equal, not just isomorphic, where you're from?
So without the R, they're isomorphic. There's some mapping between them. And that mapping is the R matrix. Okay, so if you put angle brackets around this, it becomes a K, and then maybe you can see what's going on. Okay? So with the R, I actually want to say that they're equal. Okay? But the problem with this is that it only really applies, if you think about it, when we're directly fusing these particles into a C particle. Right? This is just some basic rule. So what happens if we have something more interesting? We have a bunch of anions, and we want to braid two of them that are somewhere in the middle. Right? So suppose we have a basis state that looks like this. And we want to braid through the particles, say these two. Okay, how do we do that? Because we can't do that, we can't apply this matrix directly, right? Because this picture says, well, this one first has to merge with this one before it merges with this one. Right? And that's not what this picture is about. Okay? So we have to do a little work before we get to something of the right form. So what are we going to do? Well, the first thing is let's, okay, so let's, A, B, C, D, E, F. So the first thing we want to do is get rid of that problem. We want to put it into a form that looks like this. So what we want to do, we want to braid these two. And to do that, we have to merge this C particle directly with this D particle. Okay? And so to do that, we have to move this branch down here. Right? So looking at kind of this part here. Well, how do we do that? Well, we have to apply one of these F matrices. That's, in fact, exactly what an F matrix does. Right? If we want to take a branch and move it down here, we apply F. Okay, so if we take the appropriate F, so there's a bunch of different Fs, right? There's for all the different junctions, this sets of three here. But we apply the appropriate F to this, and we get, what do we get? Let's see, we get AB here, and they merge here. And now C is merging directly with D, and then the combination merges with the thing that merged in B, and then we merge in E. Okay. Okay, then maybe I should have left more space on the left. But so now we have this combination of C and D combining into a particle directly. So we can apply the R matrix. Okay? So if we apply R to this segment, what do we get? We get A, B up here, and we have to swap C and D appropriately. So D is going to be on top. Okay? Everyone see how that works? And then we have to look. Then we have to look at Then fortunately, we're not in standard basic anymore. So we have to move this thing back up here so that we're merging things in order. And to do that, all right. So where am I going to do it? Yeah, okay. So to do that, I want to look at this segment again, right? Where we again have two particles and a third particle merging, right? But now it's going the other way. Now instead of moving something down, we move something up. So we do that with an F inverse. And so now this C is coming up here. The D is here. E, yeah. Okay? Yeah, so I think I do this the opposite of the way that, I wasn't very careful even in my notes with the conventions. But so let's call this overall operation B inverse. Okay, so that B inverse is equal to F inverse RF. Right, we apply F first and then R and F inverse. So B is equal to F R F inverse, is that right? No, that's not right. Okay, so we'll call this. Yeah, well, and it's also the inverses don't work either, so that's not the right solution. Okay, well, let's just call it what's written down here. Let's call this B. This will be F inverse RF. Okay. These things are only matter up to a convention, which is you have to be consistent again, and I probably wasn't even consistent in my notes. So we'll just have some factors that may not work out right, but treat this as a qualitative thing. If you really want to work on this, you'll have to go back to more original papers and get these things right. Anyway, so the point is, this B is what happens to the basis states when you breed two things that are somewhere in the middle. Okay? So, to answer Lucy's request, we have a representation of the grade group. And sigma I gets mapped onto the appropriate bi. Okay? So this bi is implementing on the Hilbert space the ith generator of the grade group. So by if you want to do an arbitrary grade, well, you just multiply the appropriate bi's. Yeah. And that tells you what happens to go from the original basis to final basis. Okay. Questions? No? No questions. Okay. So now we kind of have the tools to do lots of stuff. So we have a Hilbert space. In the case of the Fibonacci onions, we have its dimensions. We can say, well, in general, if you have a non-abelian model, because there's multiple, at some point in here, there's multiple ways to do things. So when you look at a big enough tree, you'll always get a 2 eventually. Right? So you'll always eventually have a 2-qubit Hilbert space you can work with. Sorry, 2-dimensional Hilbert space, which is your qubit. In general, it's true that the dimension will grow exponentially as a power of some number, the quantum dimension. And so we will be able to embed n-qubit Hilbert spaces in this many anion thing. Now, it's not always true that by doing these braid operations, we can do universal operations. For the Fibonacci anions, it will be true. And that's the important thing. So we're going to take a bunch of anions, embed our 2-bit in them, and then do braids to do universal gates. We'll talk about that a little bit in the second half, probably. Okay? But we have the basic tools here. We have the Hilbert space, and we have the braiding. So once we know what these BI matrices are, we can just forget about all this complicated stuff and say, well, okay, so now we can just treat it as if some finite dimensional Hilbert space. How do we implement gates? Okay? So, what are the BIs? Well, I'm not quite ready to tell you that. The problem is that that's something that we haven't quite specified in the anion model yet. Right? I mean, we didn't say really what the F matrix was. It could be anything as far as we know. And the R matrix, again, it could be anything as far as we know. So why do I say for the Fibonacci anion, this braiding is universal, right? If we could just pick anything, well, sure, we can pick it to be universal, but how do we know that the actual system will implement that? And the answer is there's some more constraints. Okay? And let's do it down here. Actually, here. Okay, and the reason we get these constraints is that there's lots, we can do lots of different combinations of these F moves using the F matrix or the R moves using the R matrix. So for instance, we could take a basis state that looks like this. So with four anions merging. Okay, and so we could let's see, the first thing we're going to do is look at this. Look at this set of three. So we can apply an F move there, right? We have three anions merging. So we can apply an F move to move this down to the lower branch. So if we do that, what do we get? We get this, right? Yes, yes. And so now what do we have? Well, we have, again, three that come together like this. So let's apply another F move there. So this one is now merging down here. Okay. So now we have the tree where we merge them in the opposite order. Instead of top to bottom, we've gone bottom to top. Okay. But we could go further. We could say, well, okay. Now let's look at this bottom subtree. That's again three anions merging. Well, we can't move anything further down, but we can move something up here. We can move this middle one up to the top branch. So doing that, using F inverse, we get this, I believe. Right? And now we can take this branch, look at this set, which has 1, 2, 3 anions merging, and move this up. Hold on.
Yeah. When you apply those F, right, you have to, there's a specification on which.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, oh, okay. So like the first F and the second F.
They're different.
They're different, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, that's right. So if we do this, we do an F inverse, move this branch up, we get this. Okay? And then you can see we're almost back to here. All we have to do is move this branch up. So that says take this set of three and apply an F inverse. And when we do that, we get back here. Okay? And doing all of that can take us back to where we started. So it could be the identity. So this sequence of two Fs and two F inverses has to give us the identity. And that's a constraint on the possible value of F. So this is called, for reasons I'm sure you can deduce, these type of relations are the pentagon equations. Okay?
Is it unique?
Is it unique? What do you mean?
Can we go around the Pentagon?
In different ways?
Yeah.
I mean,
Or does it matter?
I mean, so at each stage, since there's only four, if you look at this type of thing, there's only four particles at any given time, right? And our F moves only know how to deal with three adjacent particles. So at any given time, there's only two choices that you can do for which those three adjacent particles are, basically, the top or the bottom. I think that's correct. In that case, if you look at any one of these pictures, there's only two ways you can go. One of them is forward and one of them is backwards. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you look at this picture, you can do this combination, or you can look at this combination, which will take you back to here. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to look at this set of three, for instance, because they don't directly merge. Okay? So because there's only two rules at each time, so there's two ways you can go around. There's clockwise and counterclockwise, but obviously they get the same relation. You could, on the other hand, look at a bigger system that has five atoms, and then there's various things you can do. It turns out it doesn't give you any new equations, but those can all be deduced from these Pentagon equations. But of course, there's a different set of equations for all the different possible labels. That is important. Okay. So anyway, there's another similar kind of relation that applies when you throw R into the mix. So how does this work? So now we're just dealing with three particles. And we're going to label them to help keep track. So if we apply an F move here, we can go to this. And so now what we're going to do is apply R here. Okay, and I will keep track of the over-under thing. That makes it too hard to understand what's going on. So what happens when we do that is we get, the BC branch goes up top. So we get this. And then A merges down here. Okay, everyone see how this comes from here? What happens is we're braiding this combined particle with this top one. So I guess that was something that I mentioned at the beginning, where we take these two particles, conceptually fuse them, and then move them around some other particle, mm-hmm. doing it careful not to change their order. Questions? Okay, well, let me get to the end of the diagram, and maybe there'll be questions then. You'll have more time to think about it. So what do we do now? Well, we do another F move. And what does that do? That moves the C back down. So now we have this picture, B, C, A. And from here, so now we want to do an R move on this combination. Although, actually, I guess it turns out it's an R inverse to get the braiding right. And so what that does is it gives us B up here, and then merge down here, which is AC. Okay. Now we want to move A up, so we do an F inverse.
Why is it an R inverse and not just R?
Well, so again, the over-under part I haven't been keeping track of. Offhand, I couldn't tell you. And it may not even be obvious from the pictures. You have to be even more careful than I'm being with the over-under. But it turns out that's what it is. And then to finish off, you can see to get from here back to here, we just want to switch these two with an R move. But again, it's an R inverse. Okay, and we're back to the start. And I think I heard someone say what his name was. The hexagon equation, of course. And of course, these set constraints on both R and F together. Yes?
It may seem funny, but I was thinking that, isn't it odd that these 5F, 2F, and 3F inverse goes to the
identity? That 2F is odd, that 2F is equal to 3F, basically, because if you go this way and this way. Maybe. I don't know if this has anything to do with it. No, it probably doesn't. But there are kind of five charges that are interesting here, right? Five indices, external indices, right? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm not sure if that has anything to do with it or not, like I said, but maybe that helps make it less odd. It's just the way it works. But that kind of, course, doesn't tell you why you have 6 here.
So you can say basically that F times F minus 1 is the cosmo identity.
Oh, F times F minus 1 is equal to the identity. But you have to remember that these are different Fs, right? Because they're applied to different parts of the subtree. So if you put on all the indices here, you'd see that they were really different things. But if you use the same indices, then you do get that. Yeah.
Can you define the F by its action on only one basis state, right?
Well, okay. So yeah. So again, if you had, so this is the point is that the Hilbert space. So if you look at the external labels here, there might be multiple possible internal labels, right? Like in the case of three ones merging to a one in the Fibonacci model. Okay, so this is really then a non-trivial relation, right? It could be a two-dimensional matrix. And in fact, I mean, I haven't explicitly labeled this. It doesn't have to be taking the basis states here to the basis states here. It could be off-diagonal matrix. So it could be that a specific value here is going to a superposition of values for this internal label. And in fact, for the Fibonacci model, I think that's true for the other. Okay? So that's important, because it means we have something interesting happening.
Right. But it also, I guess my question is more, is it unique, or are we still going to have to define other things
So it turns out that these pentagon equations and hexagon equations put enough constraints so that it's, at least for the Fibonacci model, I'm not sure about the general, it's effectively unique, which means, you know, up to some phases that you can get rid of and complex conjugation and things like that. The upshot is that there effectively really is only one Fibonacci model once you've defined the charges and the fusion rules, then the F matrices and the R matrices, you're forced to some particular form. I'm not completely sure that was the question, but it's still the next thing I was going to say. So, any other questions? Okay, so I. So I don't think I can quite finish. Yeah, so I think it's a good time to take a break. So we'll take the usual 5-minute break and come back, and I'll finish telling you what these matrices are for the Fibonacci model and talk a little bit about how you get universal computation out of that. And then for the remainder of the lecture, we'll do something different. Okay? So let's see. So those who haven't yet picked them up, I had graded problem sets.